Good morning. I'm Maeve Conran, and coming up on today's Morning Magazine, ahead of this morning's US Select Committee on the Climate Crisis, first field hearing that happens in Boulder this morning, we'll hear from a member of Extinction Rebellion Boulder. They're going to be part of a rally that's convening outside the hearing starting at 8:30 this morning. They'll be talking about why urgent action is needed on the climate crisis. Then today's Colorado Day. It's also the first day of the tenure of the new state historian. We'll hear from William Way, who's a professor of history at CU Boulder and an expert on Asian Americans in the Rocky Mountain West, on what he hopes to achieve during his tenure. After the latest news on cannabis with Leland Rucker, John Lendorf will join us live in the studio for Radio Nibbles. Then just after 8:30 this morning, we're going to hear from a woman who's lived here in Boulder County for 30 years, but she's now working with women in her home country of Mali through her non-profit Agile that instructs women in sustainable farming practices that increase food production in West Africa. But first, we'll begin with the latest local headlines. Here's Hannah Lee Myers.
Wednesday, a district attorney ruled Colorado State University was correct in its decision not to release unedited footage of a fatal student shooting in July of 2017. The judge believes the CSU Police Department showed the appropriate level of discretion when refusing to hand over the original video. The victim's mother filed a lawsuit against CSU to obtain the original footage, claiming she wanted to have the body cam video examined by experts to determine if it was edited. She also says she wanted to have the audio amplified so she can hear her son's final words. The Coloradoan reports the 19-year-old was shot by police when he charged officers while holding a knife after saying he wanted to die. The victim's mother, who filed the suit, claimed the police called the police earlier in the day after her son threatened a family member, saying she feared the victim may harm her other son. A district attorney cleared the officers of any wrongdoing following an investigation, during which the court heard evidence that the officers told the victim to drop the knife more than 40 times. The mother was able to view the original body cam video before the edited version was released to the press, but she claimed she believed officers edited the publicly available audio for the 911 call and the body cam footage to their benefit. Governor Jared Polis announced Wednesday that Colorado has received federal approval for a new reinsurance program that will reduce the cost of health insurance for people who buy it through the individual marketplace. The Colorado Sun reports that reinsurance is a form of protection for insurance companies for the handful of very high-priced claims that they cover every year. Currently, insurance companies distribute the anticipated cost of those high-priced claims across everybody's plans, resulting in higher costs for everyone. The reinsurance program allows the state to cover the most expensive medical claims. That will allow private insurers to lower rates across the board for people getting health insurance through the Connect for Health Colorado exchange that was created under the Affordable Care Act. Even though state lawmakers approved legislation allowing the reinsurance program in the most recent legislative session, it still needs federal approval. That's because approximately two-thirds of the costs will be paid for with federal funds, which currently are used for tax subsidies for those purchasing insurance through the exchange. Wednesday, a worker was pronounced dead at the scene of a fire at a Weld County oil and gas well. The Denver Post reports the fire broke out around 6 p.m. last night at a well near Weld County Roads 66 and 23. Firefighters put out the fire by 10 p.m. The cause of the fire remains unknown and is under investigation. A spokesperson for Great Western Oil and Gas Company that owns the site is expressing their condolences to their lost employee's family during this difficult time. And one of Denver's largest oil and gas companies, Whiting Petroleum Company, is facing difficult times of a different sort, saying they must cut 33% of their workforce, around 254 jobs, after posting millions of dollars in losses for yet another quarter. Around 95 of those layoffs will impact executive and corporate positions in the company's downtown Denver offices. Colorado Politics reports the company is not citing changes in oil and gas regulations as the major reason for their financial setbacks, but is instead blaming the losses on crude oil production drops and drops in prices. You will hear more in the Morning Magazine about oil and gas issues in focus today at the climate crisis hearing in Boulder, coming up on the Morning Magazine. And expect a high today around 84 degrees, low tonight somewhere around 60 degrees. We see highs right around 90 degrees for the next couple days with storms in the afternoons. It's currently around 68 degrees on the Front Range. For KGNU, I'm Hanalee Myers.
It is 9 minutes past 8 o'clock. Well, as we've been reporting, the U.S. House Select Committee on the Climate Crisis convenes its first field hearing later this morning. It starts at 9 a.m. at the Wolf Law Building on the CU Boulder campus. But right now, activists are starting to gather for a rally that begins at 8:30. A coalition of groups, including 350.org, Food and Water Watch and Extinction Rebellion will be there. I spoke with Michael Benslow of Extinction Rebellion Boulder, and I asked him if he was heartened that the committee was meeting right here in Colorado.
I think it's great to have this committee that's been formed. And so to an extent, you could say that, you know, there's an acknowledgement of the climate crisis. You know, the first demand of Extinction Rebellion is that the government tell the truth about the climate and the wider ecological emergency. So, and then, you know, begin to enact policies that align with that position. So I don't think that we're quite there, but I think this is a great first step. And I think it's great to have it in Boulder.
Some of the folks who are going to be speaking to the committee on Thursday are local elected officials. So from the governor, Jared Polis, to the mayor of Boulder, the mayor of Fort Collins, talking about what's happening here. Now, despite efforts to enact state legislation, and to enact efforts locally to get to a carbon neutral future, you know, there's still criticism being levied at some of these elected officials for, you know, despite their efforts, it's still a drop in the bucket compared to what really needs to happen.
Yeah, so I think I'd say two things about that. I mean, the first thing is when it comes to Extinction Rebellion, you know, the demand is 2025. So net zero by 2025. The second thing would be that when we first heard about the panel, I think there was potentially, you know, the idea was that we would have people who were leaders in these areas, who had solutions, who are working towards these goals. As you know, I mean, Boulder is a leader in many, many things, from science to innovation to technologies. So I guess the fact that it's more of a becoming a little bit more of a political event is perhaps not ideal. Not that these people don't have things to add to the conversation, but I was hoping to hear more from some of those innovators who actually have solutions, have ideas about how to meet these goals.
The committee starts its meeting at 9 o'clock on Thursday morning. Now, ahead of that, there will be a rally outside, and there's a whole coalition of different groups, including Extinction Rebellion, 350.org, Food and Water Watch, and a whole variety of other groups that are calling for more immediate action, more urgent action when it comes to the climate crisis. So in terms of whose voices will be heard, they won't be heard in any official capacity, but could you maybe talk a little bit about that rally and how some of the activist voices will be heard?
Yeah, there's lots of wonderful groups coming together. I think you can see that, especially around, you know, in the last 6 months to a year, there's been sort of a renewed sense of passion and urgency around these issues. And a lot of these groups are working together and finding a common cause. And so I think it's great that there's going to be 350 and all these different groups are going to be, you know, rallying together tomorrow to hopefully, you know, make some of our demands and our concerns and our solutions heard by these politicians and by the media. I mean, I can't speak, you know, too many specifics about what exactly is going to happen at the rally, but my hope is that we'll have lots of different people. You know, one really exciting thing about this is that we have a lot of new people who have never been involved in these kinds of things and who are joining, especially, you know, you're probably aware, Extinction Rebellion is a relatively new organization. So it's really exciting that so many new people are coming on and saying they want to be part of this movement.
As you said, Extinction Rebellion is relatively new. So give our listeners who may not be familiar with what's happening with Extinction Rebellion a sense of what your mission is and maybe how it either fits in with some of the other environmental action groups or really how it differs from that. And then how big is that movement locally?
Well, I think, you know, I think there's some very clear demands, I think, that are very clear and coherent. I think that's, you know, it's generally a very positive sort of group. I think a lot of people are drawn to that. I think if you look at the principles of Extinction Rebellion, I think you'll see that there's some things that are very unique. I think one of the things that's very unique about Extinction Rebellion is what's called the regenerative culture. The regenerative culture is sort of creating a culture which is healthy, resilient, and adaptable. So it makes space for acknowledging, you know, that these are tough issues and that these may have emotional aspects to them, and that, you know, these can affect people in different ways. So there's sort of an acknowledgement about, you know, how getting involved, how putting your energy out there can be, you know, it at times can be draining, at times it can be, you know, difficult. And these are very serious issues. So I think Extinction Rebellion really tries to make space for that. And I think a lot of people are drawn to that. I think one of the other things that's wonderful about Extinction Rebellion is, you know, trying to work collectively, trying to welcome everyone as part of it. One of the principles that I particularly came to really sort of to grab onto is the eighth principle, which is that to avoid blaming and shaming. So, you know, let's not spend too much time on sort of the negativity, and, you know, the system itself is toxic, so not one individual is to blame. So let's not put our energy towards attacking certain individuals or certain other groups, but let's try and, you know, work towards solving the problem, because the whole system is what is broken or what is toxic. And I think, you know, we have to remember the difference between a rebellion and a revolution. So, you know, we're trying to help our government make better choices. We're not trying to overthrow the government. We're a rebellion. So we're trying to let our voices be heard about how to make the change that we want to see. And I think those are a couple things that come to mind for me.
Michael Benslow of Extinction Rebellion Boulder. He's going to be at the rally that starts in just about 14 minutes time at 8:30 this morning outside of the Wolf Law building. That's where the first field hearing of the US House Select Committee on the Climate Crisis convenes today. Now, Michael Benslow emphasises that Extinction Rebellion is involved in non-violent direct action, and he says because of that approach, they attract a real diverse group of activists. Now, we're going to hear from many of those this afternoon at 3 on Metro. We'll have a full report from today's rally, but also, we'll hear excerpts from the meeting. That's this afternoon at 3. Well, today, Colorado celebrates its 143rd birthday. It is Colorado Day. And it's also the first day of the tenure of William Way as the new state historian. The professor of history from CU Boulder is an expert in Asian American history in the Rocky Mountain West. His latest book is Asians in Colorado, A History of Persecution and Perseverance in the Centennial State.
The Chinese came, like many people who have come to Colorado, to work. All they wanted to do was find work so they could support their families. And their families, for most of them, was overseas back in China. So they came to work. They came, you know, to participate in the Colorado Gold Rush. They came to work on the railroads. They helped to build the infrastructure that has made Colorado a viable place to live. And they were employed in other ways as well. But even though there was a chronic need for laborers, and they were in part welcomed for their labor by some Coloradans, others, you know, saw them as a threat. They saw them as a threat, economic competitors, the usual problem. They work too hard for too little, and some people say that's unfair, right? And especially people who themselves were experiencing difficulties in the economy as a result of the business cycle that is part of a capitalist economy. There's ups and downs, and it always affects workers. It doesn't matter, you know, what ethnic or racial group you belong to, it will affect you. The problem is that they often look for a scapegoat, you know, to explain their problems. And they think if they somehow deal with the scapegoat, this will be a panacea for their problems, and it isn't, because that's not the source of the problem. And that's where they've often been, shall we say, persecuted. They were, quite frankly, forced into fewer and fewer occupations. They started out, like others, panning for gold. You know, they were placer miners, right? And they worked in some of the other underground mines, mining for coal and other resources. But because of this, they were driven out, you know, of occupations by other workers who, quite frankly, were immigrants themselves and should have known better. But they were mainly concerned about their own livelihood, their own standard of living, and they would drive them out of these occupations, force them into fewer and fewer lines of work. One of the ones that was most popular were laundries. Now, let me be the first to tell you that Chinese are not disposed to washing other people's clothes for either biological or cultural reasons. They only did it because that was one of the few occupations that they were allowed to enter. Same thing for cooking. They ended up cooking food for others, opening up restaurants, because that's one of the professions that they were allowed into. And it was problematic. Things got so bad for them that they suffered the infamous Denver race riot, an anti-Chinese race riot that occurred on October 31st, 1880, in which an estimated quarter of the Denver population descended on Chinatown and engaged in raping and pillaging.
That's William Wei, who is a professor of history at CU Boulder, an expert in Asian American history in the Rocky Mountain West. In fact, his latest book is Asians in Colorado, A History of Persecution and Perseverance in the Centennial State. And today he becomes the new state historian. Now, we'll post an extended interview with Professor Wei at news.kgnu.org. We'll broadcast that in the coming weeks as well, where he draws parallels between what's happening right now with immigration policy, with what's happened in the past, with how other immigrants have been treated, and on the need to really learn history and learn diverse histories, particularly here in Colorado. So we'll post that at news.kgnu.org. It is 8:21. You're listening to KGNU. Leland Rooker is the senior editor at Sensi Magazine, and he joins us on Thursday mornings to talk about the latest news in cannabis. Today we're going to touch on a subject that we've talked about before, and this is the federal prohibition on marijuana and its impact on research because of the inaccessibility of cannabis for researchers, particularly in publicly funded educational institutions. And we've talked about the impact on CU researchers, even though Colorado is a state that has legalized cannabis. This is coming to the forefront again, and particularly this researcher out of Arizona, Dr. Sisley, and she's actually federally approved to do research on cannabis.
That's correct. She has a couple of different studies going. And the problem is that since it's not legal on a federal level, the only place that U.S. scientists can get product to study comes from a 12-acre farm that the government uses for that purpose in Mississippi. And researchers have to request the marijuana, and much of what is sent to them is of a subpar quality. It's just not the kind of quality that people are getting in stores, for instance. And now Dr. Sue Sisley, she's licensed to study cannabis, and for years she's been battling this. It's been going on since 2009. And one of her studies is whether cannabis can be used by veterans for pain and for possibly PTSD. And the suit says that federally supplied marijuana is so bad that it's sabotaging her research. And this from, you know, federal agencies now are calling for more research, but they're making it just as hard to do research because of this particular problem. And she really wants to grow her own is what it comes down to. And she says the plants are okay. It's not anything wrong with that, but the processing sucks. That's basically what it is. Buds are ground up along with extraneous plant material. She says many subjects don't even want to use the pot provided, that much of it is moldy and long past harvest and can't be used for legitimate research. And like we said before, the University of Colorado did a study where they looked at the marijuana that comes from this facility as opposed to the marijuana that you can buy legally across the United States. And it's way of subpar quality. It's kind of like the old stuff that used to be smuggled in from the border, you know, in the 1970s. And so here she has this product, this project, and it's looking at vets with PTSD, and it's a triple blind study using flower with various consistencies of THC and CBD. And patients used up to 1.8 grams per day. They record the effect. They're evaluated then by a third party. She's really proud of this. She really thinks this might do something. But in the 2 years since the DEA announced it would begin approving more cultivation applicants, it hasn't done anything. It really hasn't. There's been two dozen that have applied. Nobody has gotten one yet. And, you know, so between the DEA's refusal to approve applications and its persistence in keeping cannabis a Schedule I drug, Cicely says the agency is just it's kind of a continuous attack on scientific study. And here's the key thing. Dr. Cicely gets a lot of press in the cannabis sphere. And she's really considered, you know, like a cannabis advocate and somebody who's really out there in the forefront for cannabis. But the final irony of all of this is that she's a scientist. And that's really, she's not an advocate. And this is what she told the Phoenix New Times. She said, "People think I'm an activist, but all we ever wanted to be were scientists. The government forced us into that role. I don't value cannabis. I value objective data. That's why we're in this." Wow, what a concept.
People can read more cannabis news online at sensimag.com and catch Leland Rucker here on KGNU Thursday mornings. Thanks, Leland.
Thank you.
Time now for Radio Nibbles.
Have a banana, Hannah. Try the salami, Tommy. Give it to gravy, Davy. Everybody eats when...
Everybody eats on Thursday mornings, especially when John Lendorf joins us live in the studio. Good morning, John.
Good morning, Maeve.
It is that time of August. It's the first day of August, in fact. Kids getting ready to go back to school, but Boulder County Fair is coming to town.
Yes, and this really puts things in perspective. This is the 150th Boulder County Fair. Think about it. You know, long before farm to table, there were mostly farms and people ate at the table. it's been part of our community life since then. And it's taking place this week and this next week in Longmont. And, you know, I mean, there's all the usual things that you love at the fair, you know, going to see the animals and all that stuff. But they really have heightened the amount of local food that's featured. You know, it used to be, you know, kind of corn dogs and stuff, and now there's a lot of local food available. One thing they're doing, they're having the 7th annual farm-to-table dinner at the fair in the picnic area, which makes so much sense.
And which farms will be participating in that?
Sean Gaffner of the Roost is putting together a menu. It includes things like, you know, fresh roasted Japanese eggplant, but also sous vide lamb and pork loin from the Buckner family farm. Listeners will know our friend Buck Buckner. And this is his family. So that's going to be there. And best of all, of course, there will be pie, summer fruit galette with fresh basil and mint whipped cream, plus local beverages from Dryland Distillers.
Well, moving well beyond corn dogs at the Boulder County Fair, but there's lots of activity still happening with local food. Of course, all the farmers markets in full flow.
And this weekend, the farmers market in Longmont which I haven't been to enough, but which is really wonderful, and it's different from Boulder. At the Longmont Farmers Market this weekend, you're going to find apricots and cherries and fennel and kohlrabi and peaches and peppers and strawberries. It's really, now is the time to just, you know, eat straight from that.
Lots of great stone fruit coming to the marketplace now. Now, you've got an interesting column this week in the Boulder Weekly.
Yes. It asks the musical question, will it grill? And so I found a chef, Kyle Mendenhall, who's been on the air here, and I asked him about various things, you know, that you could cook over fire or, you know, over wood or gas. And, you know, I asked him whether you could grill cucumbers or butter or bread or bananas. You can find out in Nibbles in today's Boulder Weekly.
Well, lots of food news as well. In the last minute or so that we have, gives a brief synopsis of some of the fun things happening.
A wonderful. You really need to get to the Taste of Middle East, August 3rd in Centennial. All your favorite Middle Eastern foods are there. And I just wanted to mention, so at the Watergate Hotel, there's a scavenger hunt for kids. You know, you go to dinner there. The kids can go on a scavenger hunt that includes the room where the Watergate break-in was planned.
Oh, sounds fun.
Doesn't it? Hey, Maeve, what's the best thing you tasted lately?
I have an answer to this. It is a mole, a chicken mole on a blue corn taco. And it's at a new restaurant in North Longmont, Blue Corn Tacos on North Main Street. Delicious. I'm a big fan of mole.
God, that sounds great. And it's called?
Blue Corn Tacos.
That's the name of the
place? Yeah, a new restaurant just opened up recently, North Main in Longmont.
I can put that in my column next week.
Well, you can read John's writing in Sensi Magazine, Colorado Avid Golfer, the Loveland Reporter Herald, of course, the Boulder Weekly. Catch him Thursday mornings right here. Bon appétit.
Bon appétit.
All of my friends are welcome. Don't make me coax you, moax you. Eat the tables, the chairs, the napkins, who cares? You gotta eat if it chokes you.